This is Wyman and Bob on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studio.
Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Dave Wyman and Bob Stelton.
All right, audience, this is where you guys jump in, participate, because today, June 17th, 1994, was an epic day in sports. So in that light, in that honor, in that theme, we're asking you to identify a memorable day in sports history for you. It could be good, could be bad, but the date and what the event was and some of the things that took place today, and we were talking about a 30 for 30 they were doing on ESPN. First and foremost was the O.J. Bronco chase that was above everything that was going on that day, and they were talking about how at one point there were 20 helicopters that were following the Bronco, and an estimated 95 million people were watching that whole thing. I mean, just madness.
95 million. And back then, that was, yeah. I mean, those are huge numbers.
Well, you had that, and then you had Game 5 of the NBA Finals, the Rockets and the Knicks, and we were watching it during the break there, you know, just the clip of them going back and forth with Ewing and Olajuwon and all those players, and going, they've got no idea what's happening outside of that building.
Yeah.
They don't have any idea. The world is tuned into every news outlet there is trying to watch this Bronco chase.
And then it was, what was the stat, Mike? Ken Griffey Jr., we saw.
Yeah, tied Babe Ruth.
30th home run.
Most home runs before June 30th. Hit his 30th off David Cone. He souped it out there in the water.
And it was a floater.
It was a floater out there in Kansas City. So that happened. You had Arnold Palmer playing his final round at the U.S. Open. Opening game of the World Cup, hosted on U.S. soil for the first time. So in terms of sports, huge things happening. The O.J. thing overtook everything.
Right. Weren't the Islanders also having their
Rangers. New York Rangers. So a lot going on in New York that
The
time.
Rangers were, you know, having their parade, for Stanley Cup parade, basically.
So,
all kinds of stuff going on.
What a crazy day. What a crazy day.
I wish I remembered where I was. I was telling you during the break, I was living in between Denver and here, and I think we were driving back. But I shared a moment when the verdict came down with O.J., with a guy named Keith Burns, who was a linebacker for the Broncos, and now he coaches for the Chargers. And I just remember it was just me and him in our little conference room that we had, and we're watching the result, and we just were like, wow. Mm. Just, you know,
it was
marveling over the whole thing. You know, all that looked, he looked like he was guilty the entire way, and especially after, you know, the slow white Bronco parade there.
Yeah. Yeah. That was the other thing. We're going, how fast was that thing going? Because it looked like he was going a very reasonable speed. It wasn't a high speed chase.
No.
Or at least it didn't appear. It was like the Bronco was Gronk and it was outrunning everybody, but looking like it was moving very slow.
It looked like it was going like 45, 50 miles an hour.
Yeah.
Did you come up with a few dates?
I mean, I've got events. I don't know the exact dates on a lot of things. I mean, you and I were talking about it during the break. Obviously, the Seahawks winning the Super Bowl in New York. It was February 2nd, right?
2014.
Yeah, because then the following February 1st of 15 was a nightmare day.
It's also on my list.
Yeah, I mean, those are two of the most recent, for polar opposite reasons, that you're going to remember. I mean, I remember being in the stands for that when Percy Harvin ran that ball back. And we were in the auxiliary press area, so we were outside, and it was cold out there, and Brady Henderson was next to me sitting in the seat, and Percy takes off, and I'm going, he's going, and I'm like grabbing his arm and shaking him, he's going, and just shaking him, and he's like, let go, I had his arm. I was just going nuts at that game. It was a long-time Seahawks, lifelong Seahawks fan to see that in person was just, and the game was, you know, there was still a half of football to go, but that felt like the nail in the coffin there.
Right.
Even though they were crushing them at the half.
But it was the nail in the coffin. That was it. That's when you knew. By the way, Moyer used to do that to me in the booth all the time when we were doing pregame. You know, we'd go up and watch the games, and he would sit there and hit me like, look at him go, look at. I'm like, dang it.
I wouldn't do that for a regular game. It was just the excitement of being there at the Super Bowl. Percy Harvin with that play at the beginning of the half was just amazing.
Well, and then, you know, unfortunately, I have February 1st, 2015, Super Bowl 49. And for a long time, you know, after that, we would go down to spring training every year. And every time we would go out to Peoria, we'd go past that building, and I would get a sick feeling in my stomach. Like, literally get like feel sick because of that. And I'll never forget, I did television before that game, and we were outside, and you know, it was sunny out there. It was it wasn't super hot. I got totally scorched. I was sunburned. So at the end of the game, and I remember, I think you asked if, you said people were asking if I was really, it looked like I was really mad.
Yeah, you were very red.
Well, I was mad, but I was also sunburned, much like you a few weeks ago when you went paddleboarding.
Yeah, I got cooked.
Yeah, so, but yeah, I remember that. I remember, you know, having to go down and talk about that on the field. It was me and Max Strong doing Q13, and we're like, I don't know what to say. It was just, I just couldn't believe that Malcolm Butler made that play.
I remember that moment in my friend's living room. It was just me, him, and one other person in there watching the game, and they were both yelling and screaming, what happened? What the bleep? And I just sat there stone-faced in silence. It was like being in shock. Yeah. You know, you hear about people getting in accidents, and they're in shock. They don't realize they're hurt. They don't feel anything. That's what it felt like. I just sat there. I didn't say a word, didn't move. I got up, walked in another room. I called Brock, and I said, walk me through that play. What did I just see here? Because here's what I think I saw, but you tell me what went wrong. And then we sat there and talked, and then it started sinking in. I think I started cursing the Brock, who doesn't curse, and he just he allowed it. He was gracious, but
he let you get through it.
That was just stunned. I mean, I couldn't believe it. Yeah. I felt like, here we go, two in a row. Marshawn's going to score. They're going to score a touchdown. Game over. Remember, everybody's going, what is Belichick doing? He's not calling timeout. He's not calling timeout. What's he doing?
Right.
And looked like he was just handing it to the Seahawks, and then they handed it right back.
Yeah.
Yeah.
With really one of the best plays I think I've ever seen in the NFL. I just, the physics part of it is what blows me away, that how he didn't ricochet away from that contact somehow when he hit Ricardo Lockett, Malcolm Butler, that is. I mean, he just kept going right through, and just the concentration. He had four picks last year, and by the way, we're going to see him down in that same building this year coming up. Malcolm Butler's just signed with the Arizona Cardinals. But yeah, that was just so sickening that, and I remember afterwards, so the party after Super Bowl 48, the team party, was so much fun. I remember staying up to like 4 a.m. We had to get up at like 6 to get on a plane. And remember the snow came in, and you know, there were some, we barely got off the ground. You know, they were going to start shutting the airport down. And, you know, get home, then there's the big, you know, parade and everything and how fun that was. But the next year, I remember going to the party. There was still a party. And I remember Luke Wilson coming up to me going, dude, we had that game. We had it. And I was just like, yeah, sorry, bro. He's like, I can't believe it. You know, he was still not over it. It was like 4 hours later. But remember, you know, I remember Luke talking about how there were mad guys and there were sad guys. And somebody blew their entire fist up punching a locker. Don't want to name names. And then there were people that were, you know, crying. There were people that were angry, smashing things. I mean, it was just.
That's a traumatic moment to lose in that fashion. Be different if you went out there and just got your butt kicked, or team made a big bomb at the end of the game. A cornerback falls down. Something where you're just like, oh, I can't believe it. That just seems so improbable, to say the very least. Like, everything had to go right for the Patriots, and basically everything had to go wrong for the Seahawks.
Yeah.
It's just one of those moves. A lot of people texting in. October 2nd, 1995, Mariners Angels, one game playoff. Game started before I got out of school, and I rushed home to watch the game my mom had recorded.
Moyer mentioned that one, I think, didn't he?
Yeah. Angels.
Yeah.
That was a big one. Everybody scores. Let's see. Another 425. Seahawks Super Bowl parade. About that, okay. 4th Avenue and Cherry, inside the Starbucks, corner glass on both sides of me, of sea blue and green fans, 1 million strong.
Nice.
Go Hawks. Others just relaying to our depression over that game. 206. I was depressed for a couple of months. let's see. January 2015, NFC Championship over the Packers.
That game, I know most writers already had that story written.
Yeah.
That this was just a horrible.
Four interceptions, and each one of them targeted Jermaine Kearse.
Right. And then in overtime, Russ comes back to Jermaine Kearse.
Mm.
Yeah, that was a big day. I remember being outside. We were doing the post-game show on Q13 and actually being out in the stands, you know, kind of.
Yeah.
And I've never heard such a roar. And I was, we were in, you know, the other end zone. So Golden, or not Golden Tate, but Jermaine Kearse was running away from us. And, you know, you could see the trajectory of the ball come down. So, yeah, that was a big one. You know, a lot of mine tend to be negative ones that I think about. The other one for me is November 20th, 1982. That's the play with all the laterals
and everything.
This isn't good. Actually, on the stream, I got a scar right here on my forearm. You see that?
Yeah.
Yeah, so that happened in that game. On November 20th, 1982, it was a belt, you know, a buckle, like a buckle on their helmet.
Oh.
It just, you know, laid it open. So I had to get stitches and everything.
I thought you were going to say that was you after the game taking your anger out on a locker or
could
something.
Could have been.
Cut your arm.
Very well could have been. But I don't think I did anything violent after that. I didn't slam anything down.
That had to be a moment of disbelief, too, though, where people could have been walking around going, wait, what just happened?
Well, and also we didn't really know because everybody came on the field and we left the field. So we're like, okay, let's get all the players off the field. And then they came into the locker room like 20 minutes later and told us you lost.
So for that entire 20 minutes, you weren't certain what the outcome of the game was.
Exactly. Yeah, so, I mean, it was in all the crowd down on the field. So, yeah, check out the big game, Stanford-Cal from 1982. I was on the field, actually. There's a guy writing a book about the 82 season. His name's Tyler Bridges, and he mostly writes about Louisiana politics for a paper down there, but he's a Stanford guy. And so I ended up talking to him for an hour and a half on a Zoom call, and kind of felt like I made a friend. He was really a cool guy, but you know, he's doing a whole story on that 82 season. Elway could have been the Heisman Trophy winner, I think, if we'd have won that game, because mm-hmm. he completed a 4th-and-19 pass to Emile Harry. I mean, he did a lot that year. He had a really good year, and I think if we'd have won that game, he could have maybe – it was Herschel Walker that was the Heisman winner that year.
I can't believe you guys were sitting in a locker room for that long without knowing what the outcome – did we win? Did we? Was that the conversation where you guys just sit there going, what do you think? Did we win? We won, right?
Does anybody know? What did you see? And everybody's talking about their experience and where they were and what happened. And, you know, I was on one of the tackles that – I swear the guy's knee was down, and I swear you can't see it on video, but I remember an official waving it dead, and I went running off the field. I was like, yeah, we won. I didn't even see what happened down there with running over the trombone.
The band. Yeah, so nuts. The 253 saying 1998 Rose Bowl. I'm a Coug fan. We beat UW in Husky Stadium to make the Rose Bowl. We stormed the field. I was 3 feet from Brock Huard and yelled, "You suck, Brock." And they said that day was the best. FYI, this isn't Jim Moore.
Oh, that is a beauty. That's got to be text of the week right there, man.
You're 3 feet away.
You suck, Brock. That's mean. Come on, Brock's such a nice guy.
253, Secretariat at the Belmont, June 9th, 1973.
Oh, really?
I'm not a big horse racing guy, but
I'll tell you what.
Secretariat, certainly.
I wasn't there. The Kentucky Derby in 1995, a little horse named Thunder Gulch won, and I had money on it. I won a couple $1,000.
Really?
And I didn't put that much down. It was a pretty long odds, ridden by Gary Stevens of Idaho. I think he used to run out of Emerald Downs, or actually it was Long Acres back then. So, yeah, that was kind of a cool. I went to like an offsite. I was in Arizona. I went to an offsite betting place and placed my – it was like in a bar. You know, I've looked on the internet to see. Wait, did we have internet then? I'm not sure how I found it. I probably went through the yellow pages, Bob. Anyway, yeah, that was a big moment. But I was watching it on TV, obviously. I wasn't there. But
how about this one? Boy, this is I can see why you'd remember this from the 425. May 9th, 1997. I had a heart attack in the will call line waiting to pick up tickets for Seattle Phoenix.
Oh.
Jeez.
Yikes.
I can see why you'd remember that day.
Yeah. Well, at least you're texting in.
Yeah.
How about this? One of the first later. Ones that came in on the Twitter machine. October 8th, 1995, Mariners beat the Yankees to win the ALDS.
Yeah. Everybody knows 95. If you would have asked me what day was it on, it was October, I don't know, 5th, 7th. I don't catalog the date. Obviously, you know. 95. I mean, we can't escape 95. That's all we talk about with the Mariners. So you know what happened. But, yeah, the exact day. That's when it gets a little tricky. January 4th, 2006, Rose Bowl. Longhorn fan in the stands at 10-yard line watching Vince run it in. Maybe the greatest Rose Bowl in history. USC,
Texas. USC, yeah.
Reggie Bush, Vince Young, just.
Who was the other running back that was here?
Lindale White. Yep.
Thunder and Lightning.
That was a fun team, man. That's what I lived in L.A. when that USC team was going on, and Pete was a rock star. That was the pro team in L.A. They didn't have a pro football team out there at that point.
You know, I used to always get in this argument with Jim. I don't know how you feel. The whole thing with Reggie Bush.
Yeah.
I mean, holding Pete responsible for that, his parents were dealing with his agent. His agent bought his parents a home in San Diego.
Yeah.
And, you know, I remember Jim would always say, how could he not know? And I'm like, well, how could he know? Is he supposed to follow every player around? And like, you would lay out the whole thing, and then Jim would still go, yeah, I know, but I don't care. I still think this, that, and the other.
How are you supposed to keep track of every family member of every scholarship athlete on that roster?
Exactly.
It feels impossible, or if you did, you'd have to hire a private investigator for each family.
Right.
And that kid and that family, and you keep, I mean, I can't imagine what the cost would be to keep tabs on somebody to the point where you would know if they were screwing up or doing something that was below board. That doesn't mean he didn't know. Maybe somebody whispered something to him. Maybe he did. But the idea that he should know.
Yeah.
And that's true of any coach. And I know coaches cheat and they do things. The NCAA rule book is, you know, 8 days long. So it seems very easy to break rules. Things like that, I'm just like, I don't expect that he should know. Doesn't mean he didn't, but the fact that he should, how could you not know? Very easily.
Yeah, I mean,
very
that's,
easily.
You're trying to run you're trying to call plays. You're trying to manage the clock. You got 90 scholarship players. You got, all kinds of stuff going on.
Yeah, unless somebody whispers it to you. You're worried about Reggie Bush. How are we going to get him and Lindale against the Texas Longhorn? How are we going to do this? How are we going to do this? You're not going, well, Reggie, what are his parents up to, by the way? What do they got?
Yeah.
Wait, where are they living now? I mean,
right.
That part to me, and I don't care if we're talking about Pete or if we're talking about Nick Saban. It's not about loving Pete and defending him. I think it's true of any coach. I mean, how many kids are on a college roster?
90. You got 90 scholarship athletes, typically.
Yeah. And then you got walk-ons. You got all. I mean, it's just, that's a lot. That is a lot to keep track of.
Well, and it was occurring not like right under his nose. It was down in San Diego where they bought the house. So here's one that I actually remember. I want to get the date right. 2/18/2001, Dale Earnhardt killed at Daytona. I remember seeing that. Well, it looked like a very innocuous crash.
Seeing that, it didn't even look high speed. It looked like he kind of bumped the wall almost, you know, compared to crashes where we've seen just tires and pieces of the car flying every direction. That one seemed fairly harmless to a novice at best watcher of that, and then to see the outcome was just stunning.
Yeah, very sad, and I just remember being kind of disturbed by that. Here's a good one, though. 12/11/1988, Largent hits Mike Harden, and that was about 3-4 months coming, because when we opened up that year in Denver, he got laid out. Mike Harden put his forearm right in Steve Largent's face mask
him out. What was the opinion of that hit back then? Because I watched that replay recently. I don't know if it was on Twitter or somebody posted it, but you see the Denver Bronco players high-five celebrating like, man, good hit. And I don't even know if they threw a flag on that play.
There wasn't nearly the outrage, Bob. I mean, people nowadays would have been saying, oh, he tried to kill him. Oh, put him in jail.
He might have been suspended for the rest of the year
these days.
But were players on the Seahawks sideline, were they like, angry, like that was a cheap shot, you don't do that? Or
not really. I mean, I don't remember that. I was like, dang, that was a big hit there. But I mean, it wasn't nearly as clear to see, you know. It was, everything was kind of grainy, and so I mean, in such a Steve Largent way, 3 months later, whatever it was, he got back in a fair legal way. Although I've made the case that where if you hit somebody like that nowadays, the way Largent hit Harden, you might actually get a penalty for it, because he didn't see it. He was defenseless.
Yeah, you're right.
You know, but what a great hit by Steve Largent. But it was such a, you know, because Steve was so righteous. I mean, he did everything right. And, you know, you think if he had the opportunity to cheap shot Mike Harden back, he would have never done that. And he still wouldn't to this day. But he did it legally, and he did it in the right way, in a way that I think that was as loud as I ever heard the Kingdom.
Oh, it was so – because everybody loved Steve. So you were angry for him, and you looked at that guy like enemy number one, and to see him get payback like that. Now, I think he popped up, though. He wasn't
Harden?
Yeah,
it didn't hurt. He just got the crud knocked out.
Yeah,
it
knocked the ball loose.
Yep.
And I think Largent recovered the ball.
He did.
So he jarred it loose after an interception. He
paid
hits him
back
hard enough to jar it loose, take him off his feet, and recovers the fumble.
Yeah.
So, yeah, the only thing that would have made it better is if Harden were down for a bit. Like,
yeah.
Really got his bell rung.
Right.
What about this one? I don't know if I believe this. June 20th, 2017, Vegas, at a Madonna concert, I called Sammy Sosa a roider and yelled, "Corked bat," and he began choking me. What? Come on. That's not real.
Somebody just made up a story there.
What was Sammy Sosa
doing there?
Who knows? I don't know. That'd be funny if that were true, though. November 30th, 1987, Bo emasculated Boz and runs up the King Don Tunnel. My seats were right behind the stadium brass band.
Yeah, I remember the band. They used to play a couple of songs that were not very inspiring.
Didn't they always play Tequila or something?
Dun-dun-dun-dun-dun, dun-dun-dun. It was like the Bunny Hop song.
Oh.
Dun-dun-dun. They used to play that.
Did
and
it
I
get
was
you
like,
fired up?
Yeah, I'm like, well, can't we get like a rock band out here or something? No offense to those.
Song.
Yeah, it was, man, I was like, is that supposed to get us fired up?
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, there's some good ones. We'll continue with a few of these coming up in the next segment. Also get you ready, a little preview of the Mariners series with the Tampa Bay Rays. That's coming up with Wyman and Bob on 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to Wyman and Bob on 710 ESPN Seattle. Streaming live through the Alaska Airlines studio on the 710 Sports app.
Now, here are your hosts, Dave Wyman and Bob Stelton.
We were just going through some old Seahawks highlights during the break there. Dave showing me a little montage of, what was that, 1991?
91
Seahawks.
Yeah. And the reason why I have it is because my wife, she's more prominent in any of the highlight films than I ever was.
Yeah. Her and John L. Williams. They got the most screen time there.
When we were in London, they were showing like a Seahawk promo when we were back there a couple years ago. And I look up there and Rabel's like, "Hey, there's your wife." And I'm like, "Yeah, why is she on?
Where am I?
Nowhere to be found, of course."
Well, she's very attractive, so I could see why they were putting her front and center there.
What are you saying about me, Bob?
You're less attractive.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'll accept that.
So it's interesting to see the shoulder pad. You were certainly not the only guy with big shoulder pads back then, watching all those guys on defense.
They just didn't have the technology back then.
Dan McGuire was doing a little interview, and He's got a Herman Munster head in this just tragic mullet.
It's terrible.
It is awful. It looks
red
permed.
Hair.
Looks like it may have been. I don't know if it's naturally curly, but it really, the party in the back was very curly.
Business up front.
And it was very square. It's like a cinder block, his head.
And I'll tell you what, man, I'm sure going into that, he thought he looked really fine.
Back then, he probably wasn't standing out. Nobody was going, "Look at that dude's hair." He probably looked like everybody else walking around at that point. But, man, that was tragic looking. A bunch of people texting in different dates. This March 24th, 1976, grand opening of the Kingdom and Danny Kaye introducing the Mariners to Seattle. I was in the band, Dave, and had a good time.
Well, good for you. Good for you. No, I was just, it was kind of funny, the Bunny Hop song when they would play that.
May have been dancing to that very song when you, that little clip you showed me there.
She was pretty enthusiastic in that clip. I'm not sure if she wasn't. But no, it just, I think they used to play it in the third quarter or something like that. And I was like, I always just thought it was kind of funny. I was like, what is this?
What are you doing?
But yeah, it was cool that you had a little band there. And then you see the fans. And that place just went nuts when Steve Largent got his payback on Mike Harden.
Mm. Let's see if you remember this. October 31st, 1981, the wave created at Husky Stadium. That should never have been created. Homecoming versus Stanford, kicking Stanford's butt.
1981?
Yeah.
Well, I was at Wooster High School winning a state championship. Thank you very much.
There you go. There you go.
No, I've heard that it was invented up here. And then it was, no, you don't like the wave.
No.
Were you a wave buster?
Yeah, I would sit.
I have a buddy that would, him and his friends would do the wave buster. So whenever it came around to them, they'd put their arms in front of them and hunch down.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of the wave.
Never have been.
And then seeing it at other stadiums, they're like, when I was in St. Louis, I went to some games with friends and it started going on and they're like,
hey, this started in Seattle, didn't it? And I'm like, yeah, it did. You must love this.
Not probably.
No, I don't. Yeah. No, I don't. It's ugh. A lot. Let's see.
What is it about it that you don't like? Is it like everybody?
It just became so cliche, or it just became more than the game. It's sort of like the hydro races up on the screen that would often get more of an applause or more attention than the game on the field. Yeah. It just drove me nuts. Like, I know the hydros are a big deal, but just to watch how invested people were, like, I picked red. Come on, red. I'm like, it's a cartoon. What are you doing? It's a cartoon. By the way, I think years ago when I first started in this business as an intern, Paul Moyer was up in the press box with us at the Kingdom for the hydro races. He was sitting there, and somebody that worked for the Mariners was telling us who was going to win, like which one was going to win each night. And Paul was there going, I'll take green. And we knew it was like yellow. We're like, nah, I think it's going to be yellow. And I just remember him being the guy. We kept doing that too. Like, yeah, you guys are always right. And it was like, guess, man. They were telling us which one was going to win each night, and Paul was very competitive with it.
Oh, he's very competitive. It's too bad he didn't vote on a different boat.
All right. Mariners begin a four-game series against the Rays. Little preview of this. This is going to be an interesting series because the Rays, unlike the Minnesota Twins, who are a bad team, great hitting team, terrible pitching team, this is a first-place team in the AL West, the Tampa Bay Rays. And you're going to see old Mariner Mike Zunino out there and watch this team do what they do. Rays are tied for the most wins in Major League Baseball. And the last time they faced a team that was this good was the San Diego Padres in one of the more frustrating, maddening series I've been a party to. I remember coming out of that series just mad. I was so angry. Not that they lost. They weren't even competitive. It was like they did. They weren't even there.
Shouldn't we have expected that, though? I mean, with San Diego and what they are doing and going through right now, I mean, I just...
Losing, sure. Not being representative, no. I think they're better than that. The Mariners, I'm not making a case. They're a playoff team. They're a great team. They're good enough to be present. They weren't present in that series. It was... They got eviscerated. It just wasn't competitive, Dave. I remember just coming out of it just like, ugh, I got to take a shower. That was gross.
Yeah, and I have to say that, you know, I guess I was kind of trying to be politically correct or, you know, like not politically correct, just sort of up with the times that we should embrace the celebration stuff. But it got old when Tatis was doing the little shuffle thing at third base. And yeah. It was making me mad. It was starting to make me mad. The only thing that happened good, I felt like in that series was that both Dunn and Sheffield got hits.
Yeah.
They both looked like they knew what they were doing at the time. So but that's it. Wasn't it like 31-7 that they lost?
Yeah, it was so brutal.
So hopefully a little bit better at home with Tampa. Get a chance to see Mike Zunino. So he's in the lineup tonight. So yeah, let's see JP Crawford leading off tonight. Of course, and then Haniger, Fraley, France at third base. You got Demo, who hopefully, I mean, we talked to Ryan Rowland-Smith yesterday, and he was saying that maybe maybe he's a little bit disappointed in Dylan Moore, but you know he's still hanging in there with him. And then we got the hard hitting Luis Torrens at DH with 2-for-4 last night, Bob.
He did. Hopefully, he can keep it going. Like I said, wring that sponge dry. If there are more hits in there, get them. Just hide the catcher's gear. It's unnecessary. Another interesting note to the lineup is that Taylor Trammell is not in it. So he had a night off. Then he was back last night, went 0-for-3 with 3 strikeouts, and once again not in the lineup tonight. Now, that may have something to do with the lefty going up against Rich Hill, who's a pretty crafty lefty. So, all right, maybe they're playing matchups that way. But your lineup is Crawford, Haniger, Fraley, France, Seager getting a night off too, by the way. He needs it. France, Murphy, Moore, Bowers, Torrens, and Long.
I like Shed Long. I like watching him play, and I'm hoping that he – what are your thoughts on Shed? I mean, does he look like the answer at second base long term?
Really. He's behind Dylan Moore at second base.
Yeah, but, I mean, you know, he's the younger, you know, up-and-coming guy. I always pull for him. I always root for him, but, yeah, I'm not so sure.
Yeah, I want him to be great. I just, so far, based on everything I've seen, not so much. Not so much. And somebody's mad that I don't like the wave. Why are you a wave hater? Wow, shame on people for wanting to have fun. It's called fun, Bob. All right. I didn't say you shouldn't do it. I don't think it's fun. I don't find the wave fun. Hey, look at this. This is great fun. Watch this. Woo! I just had so much fun there. Wait, I'm going to have fun again. Watch this. Woo! That was so fun. I want to do that again. All right, coming up, what are we watching out for in the month before the Seahawks training camp? We'll get into that next with Wyman and Bob on 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to Wyman and Bob on 710 ESPN Seattle. Streaming live through the Alaska Airlines studio on the 710 Sports app.
Now, here are your hosts, Dave Wyman and Bob Stelton.
According to the texters, the biggest news today and the most divisive topic is that Bob hates the wave. Bob is a wave hater.
I'm a wave hater.
Wave buster.
I'll wear it. I'll wear it with pride. I hate the wave. By the way, Mariners taking on the Rays tonight at T-Mobile Park, and the roof will be open. I'm predicting an open roof, Dave. I'm undefeated in my predictions so far.
Yeah, been good.
That's the Mariners roof report covered by Acton's Quality Roofing.
Roofing, not roofing.
Roofing. The
roof.
The rough. I like the 415 saying, I'm not surprised Bob hates fun, like the wave. When we established yesterday, he wants all teams to cheat. Then they put a smiley face. So it was a joke.
What were you talking about? Altice
remember cheating. Yesterday there was somebody saying, oh, great logic, Bob. I guess you want everybody to use like the corked bats or like somehow yeah. They thought I was saying, yeah, everybody should be able to cheat when I said nothing of the sort. But
through some perverse, twisted way, they associated you to cheating.
I guess, you know, people pull things out of our conversations that you and I will look at each other and go, wait, did you say that? I didn't hear that. Did you say that?
Yeah.
I didn't say that. So anyway, some good text. And some people agreeing. I agree, Bob, says the 360. The wave sucks. Another 206. I feel like I get you, Bob.
Yeah. I just never really thought about it that much. I don't know. I mean, if you're a player on the field, would you be thinking, hey, they're having too much fun without, they should be cheering for us? I don't know. I never even thought about it. I just remember that my first taste of Seattle was coming up here and playing the Huskies at UW, and I remember it was raining, and there was a linebacker named Joe Kelly, and I'll never forget this. He hit one of our receivers, and his name was Spencer Cotton, and he just obliterated him, and then he got up and with his jersey in his hand started like prancing around and just dragging Spencer around the field, and I'm like, he can't do that. I don't think he got flagged. And I was like, holy smokes, we're in for a long day.
Oh.
And then, you know, the crowd was just so loud and on top of you. And then, you know, it started raining, and then they just killed us. It was the year I think we went 1-10, and I hated it.
Who'd you guys beat?
We beat Oregon State. No. Oregon State beat us. Okay, this is 1983. They had not won a Pac-10 game in like 4 years. So they beat us at, what was it called? Reeser Field or something at the time.
Reese Stadium.
Yeah, they tore the goalposts down after the victory.
Oh, man.
All like 10,000 fans that were there tore the goalposts down in celebrating their first Pac-10 victory.
So who'd you guys beat?
We beat Arizona.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right.
University of Arizona was our one win.
Mm.
So, yeah, that was not good. But part of it was that, and I just remember thinking, oh, man, I hate these fans up here. Yeah, fast forward 3-4 years. I love the fans.
I love these fans. Yeah, man, the Kingdome is rocking. This place is loud.
I was talking about the Kingdome, and you know, we're going back looking at dates in history and things like that. And you know, that's what made that place great was the fans and the noise. I just loved it. But when I first came here, I come in from Stanford. There's the palm trees on the walk down to the stadium. There's trees all around the outside. Beautiful grass. You know, the only thing that was bad about that stadium, and it held like 86,000, is that there was a track. So, you know, it's not like the fans were right on top.
Right.
So, but it was just beautiful. And then I come up here, and it's like going inside an office building.
Yeah.
You know, you've got carpet and fluorescent lights and concrete.
Yeah, not a great building.
But
and we were just looking up the cost of it.
Yeah.
It's amazing. We're looking at multi-billion dollar stadiums now. The cost to build the kingdom, $67 million. $67 million. They say $305 million in 2020 dollars, which is still cheap.
Yeah. I mean, what was it? It was just concrete and, you know.
And concrete and turf.
And iron.
And seats.
A little bit of iron. Yeah. I mean, yeah. And I remember my dad was home inspector at the time, and when those panels were falling down, he was convinced that it was because they tried to pressure wash the roof or something, and the water got in there. But, yeah. Did anybody get hurt? Or
I don't think so.
I think it was during a time when nobody was there, luckily.
Yeah,
so.
I don't think anybody got hurt. And then the date that they blew it up, March 26, 2000.
Yeah.
They imploded the kingdom. So there you go. Little history there. All right, as far as what we're watching out for in the month before the Seahawks training camp, hopefully, A, first and foremost, I don't want to hear anything about anybody in the news for any reason other than something positive or something fun. Right? This is the time where coaches get anxiety, GMs are full of anxiety, too much time for players with a lot of money and no real schedule, you know, as far as team schedule to adhere to. And this is when trouble starts. The weather's nice. They've got access to their friends. Now things with the pandemic. I bet coaches last year, the pandemic probably helped them. They were this is, you know, here's a silver lining to this whole thing. But now things are opening up. This is when guys get in trouble. That's the first thing I want is no headlines attached to the Seahawks other than Jamal Adams signs extension. Dwayne Brown signs extension. Things like that. That's what I want.
How about re-signing of KJ Wright?
I'd love that too.
Yeah, I don't
Are you starting to back off on that because of what it means to Cody?
You're making it about my guy Cody. No, I just don't think, you know, they're trying to develop the young guys. I would just love to have KJ back, but you know, I would say, you know, trade somebody then. You've got some guys that should be on the field, and Cody Barton's one of them. But no, you're right, and they get so much good guidance. I talked about this yesterday, but Mo Kelly, a guy who played in the league, he has done a really good job down there of just making sure everybody knows. You know, like you said, the COVID lockdowns probably had a very positive effect.
Yeah.
But, yeah, you don't want to see – we've seen less guys getting popped for the PEDs and stuff like that. And so hopefully a nice quiet period between now and the time that they report.
Yeah, PEDs in football have just never been a big deal. I'm not saying it's right or wrong. I'm not trying to justify it. It's just fans don't react the same way they do to baseball.
Yeah.
You forget about guys. You got to sit there and rack your brain about guys who did it in football. But that's another topic for another day. That does it for us. I want to thank Paul Moyer and John Clayton for joining us on the program. If you missed anything from today's show or any day for that matter, head to the podcast page, 710sports.com. Click the podcast tab. Scroll down to our picture. Click on that. It's right there for you. We're back tomorrow right here with Wyman and Bob on 710 ESPN Seattle.